And I think most people can grasp that notion that America's past has a dark side that has been deeply constitutive of the nation, but it also has aspirations to do better that have contributed to progress and can contribute to progress and must contribute to progress if we're going to face the crises we have now and move beyond them in a constructive way.
Hello, this is the Great Battlefield Podcast. I'm Nathaniel G. Perlman. A great political battle is being fought right now between progressives and the forces of reaction on the other side. This show is about the political entrepreneurs and other progressive leaders who are finding new or improved ways to fight. Roger Smith's most recent book, That Is Not Who We Are, Populism and Peoplehood, is highly relevant to this moment in our political history, showing how to counter the appeal of Trump with stories of national identity that push in more inclusive and egalitarian directions. Rogers is professor of political science at the University of Pennsylvania, where his research and writing is on American constitutional and political development and political thought, with a focus on issues of citizenship and racial, gender, and class inequalities. We had a really good conversation. You should listen. So, after a quick word from our sponsor, my interview with Professor Roger Smith at UPenn.
Check out the large, detailed, and high-quality political data graphic posters from TimePlots. Our visual history of the American presidency, for example, lets you see the Clinton, Bush, Obama, and Trump presidencies in full context. TimePlots library includes visual histories of the United States House, the United States Senate, the Supreme Court, and the Democratic and Republican parties. Find them all at www.timeplots.com. Use the code BATTLEFIELD for a discount.
Rogers, would you mind introducing yourself and giving me a quick biography?
Yes, I'm Roger Smith. I'm the Christopher H. Brown Distinguished Professor of Political Science at the University of Pennsylvania. And I have been teaching for 40 years, working on issues of American constitutionalism, civil rights and civil liberties, and American civic identity.
That is a highly relevant thing to be educated in these days, isn't it?
Yes, I think that we're faced this year with the most striking contrast in the accounts of our national identity that the two candidates are putting forth. It's a sharper contrast than we've had in modern history.
You have recently written a book that is really about those two different visions. That Is Not Who We Are, Populism and Peoplehood. Why did you write that book?
I wrote that book because after Donald Trump unexpectedly won the 2016 election, at least in the Electoral College, I came to realize that the appeal of a kind of authoritarian nationalism that calls itself populist was more powerful than I had realized, and it's present not just in Trump's Make America Great Again movement, but in similar kinds of nationalist populist movements around the world. I wanted to understand the appeal of these movements, including Trump's appeal. Even more, I wanted to understand how that appeal could be countered by stories of national identity that pushed in more inclusive and egalitarian directions.
The way you've spoke about sort of Trump as if he has a coherent philosophy, I think there may be one there, but how do you discern that given the breadth of his communications and the lack of clarity, I think, about a philosophy?
There's no doubt that Donald Trump is a highly erratic, impulsive personality that's taken many different positions on many issues over the years. There's also no doubt that he plays to the crowd and he's willing to say anything that will get them to stand up and cheer. But nonetheless, he put together a coalition that got him to the White House by landing on some themes, some of which he'd articulated for years, others that were brought to him by figures like Steve Bannon and Steve Miller. And his administration has actually pursued those themes with remarkable consistency. He ran against what he saw as corrupt liberal globalist elites in Washington who acted contrary to the interests of most of the American people. In his view, he thought that required ending trade agreements, ending environmental agreements, curbing immigration, strengthening the police. And all of these are measures that he has pursued actively in office. He supports them through a narrative that, again, comes from Bannon and others that says that national sovereignty is endangered in today's world, and that if we restore commitments to national sovereignty and every nation looks out for its own interests, we'll have a better world. And so Trump's central theme is America first, just like in India, Modi's theme is India first. This kind of resurgent nationalism is, ironically, in some ways, a global phenomenon. It does represent a philosophy that Trump has persistently pursued.
It feels like analogous to an invisible hand of capitalism being the everyone working in their own interest ends up being in everybody's interest. Similar, if every nation works in its own interest, that'll work out. Do you see that analog?
That's an excellent analogy. There is this confidence that if every nation puts itself first, they'll take care of their people. And that means all the people in the world will eventually be taken care of by their governments. The problem is that the world today faces transnational problems, environmental issues of climate change, issues of interconnected global economic production and supply chains, as well as transnational movements of peoples that all are meaning that we have lots of problems that can't be addressed by nations acting alone. We need multilateral action to solve many problems that literally threaten humanity's existence. Trump adamantly hates multilateral arrangements. He wants just bilateral deals in which America wins. That actually is a formula for America losing and the world losing as well.
I was interviewing a guy recently, founding executive director of MoveOn. He's working on a very specific project right now, but towards the end of the interview, he started to talk about his interest in sort of global democracy, liquid democracy, removal of countries, whether they're necessary or not. And I found myself quite resistant to that notion, having, I guess, an allegiance to this country and also feeling like it's a pretty tough political road to erase countries, even though the reason he's pointing out is very similar to what you're talking about, which is we have big problems like global warming, which we can't solve, and problems like inequality. How do you fit the current necessity for countries with the needs to do bigger things sometimes?
Well, your concerns are, I think, profoundly representative of the feelings of most people that must be taken into account if we're developing strategies for progress. It is true that the current structure of nation states around the globe is a system of enormous inequality that has perpetuated and extended inequalities over the last couple of generations. At the same time, it's also true that there simply is no feasible way to move to a radically differently structured globe. We are organized into a set of particular political communities, and we have to work with that structure to try and make it more just and equitable over time. And that means instead of simply attacking loyalties to particular countries, we have to build on the best elements of those loyalties to make those countries more just and equitable and more willing to cooperate with other countries in improving the world. Now, that may mean that ultimately we move beyond the nation-state system, which has not always existed and probably won't exist, always exist through human history, but we're a long way away from moving to radical change in the global nation-state system. Our task now is to try to make it better, especially because so many of the world's leaders are now trying to make it worse.
So you seem to locate that effort in telling better stories about peoplehood. And in your book, you talk about three main ones to draw on in the U.S. to counter the sort of Trumpist ideas. Talk about what those three are and why you think that would be useful.
Well, the starting point is that every political community is what Benedict Anderson called an imagined community, a community in which people are held together by narratives that indicate that they share a common identity and purpose. Any society of any size has multiple narratives, but if there's sufficient overlap amongst them, it can help sustain allegiance to that community, willing to sacrifice for it, willing to respect and operate its institutions for the general benefit. Any such stories have to resonate with the histories and lived experiences of the populations that the hope is will embrace those stories as reasons to cooperate together and to trust each other. In America, there are a number of stories, but three, I think, are sufficiently deeply rooted in American history and experiences that they can help mobilize coalitions in more progressive and egalitarian directions. And those stories are, first, America as a democracy that seeks to become ever more a democracy. This is a story that John Dewey and many of the progressives told in ways that in their eyes ultimately might lead beyond the nation-state system, but the initial challenges were to make America a more inclusive and egalitarian democracy. There are older stories. The Constitution preamble says that the Constitution seeks to create a more perfect union, and the notion of America as a constitutional project of trying to achieve a more perfect union in ways that respect our diversity, but nonetheless find common purposes. This story that Barack Obama articulated as an e pluribus unum story, out of many one, we will become a more perfect union without facing our diversity, rather building on it. That's a compelling story for many millions of Americans. And there's the still older story stemming from the opening paragraphs of the Declaration of Independence, which says not only that all are created equal in certain unalienable rights, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, but that governments are instituted in order to secure those rights over time. And this is a story that in the pre-Civil War years, many argued meant that the Constitution should be operated in ways that ultimately ended slavery, a grotesque violation of the basic rights of life and liberty. This story was articulated by anti-slavery constitutional theorists like Lysander Spooner. It was advocated by Frederick Douglass, and it eventually became central to Abraham Lincoln and the Republican Party that won power in 1860 by saying no expansion of slavery in the territories, and eventually wrote abolition of slavery into the post-Civil War amendments, the notion of the United States as a Declaration of Independence project of seeking to secure the basic rights of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness for all people of all colors everywhere, as Lincoln put it, that's also a narrative of national identity and purpose that encourages and can guide more inclusive and egalitarian projects over time. Different stories appeal to different Americans, but I think that these stories in particular can serve to inspire a sense of American patriotism and purpose that is much better than the America First vision of Donald Trump.
I feel like I resonate to all three of those in different ways, and I think kind of grew up immersed in them. I'm a little concerned that people are less immersed in them nowadays, that there are challenges to those stories coming both from the left and the right. How do you see the strength of, you know, reaching back to them right now?
Well, that's very much a question that will be answered in the politics of this year, as well as in years to come. And actually, I am heartened on that subject by the way the national debate is going at the moment. It is true that many on the left have been deeply skeptical about any stories that appear to celebrate national identity, and they've been skeptical in particular about all these American stories because the reality of American history is one in which we have only sought to secure rights for some and not all. We've had slavery. We've had near genocide of Native Americans. We've had denial of rights to women, to immigrant groups. We have been far less than a full democracy. And we at some times have gone backwards instead of forwards toward building a more perfect union. And so for all these reasons, people on the left have been skeptical about supporting the kinds of stories of American peoplehood that I'm articulating. At the same time, this summer, we got over Independence Day weekend, Donald Trump presenting the story of the Declaration of Independence not as a call for further progress toward a more perfect union, as Lincoln and millions of other Americans have thought. Instead, what he said was that allegiance to the Declaration of Independence leads us simply to celebrate our past and celebrate our heritage without acknowledging any imperfections in a country beset by enormous public health, economic, and racial problems right now. His only proposal for carrying forward the Declaration of Independence project was to build a new national garden to American heroes. And for him, he's made it clear that those heroes include the Confederates who attacked the Union trying to defend slavery. I think most people recognize that whatever the limitations of the more progressive, democratic, constitutional Declaration of Independence accounts that I've mentioned, whatever the deficiencies of America in living up to those narratives are much more desirable to embrace than this celebration of America's past, including the worst elements of America's past that Donald Trump is promoting and tweeting and seeking to implement right now.
It seems like it might be confusing to people who aren't sort of steeped in political philosophy to have that take on, you know, the difference between honoring the Declaration and the various democratic projects and dishonoring the past the way progressives want to for the bad things. And I mean, and a campaign is such a crude way to choose among visions. Do you think that we'll have a fair test of the two different paths forward?
Clearly, there's a big challenge for Joe Biden to articulate an alternative vision of America to Trump's that moves in a more progressive, inclusive, and egalitarian direction. He actually made a good start at that in his speech in Philadelphia in early June, where he said that American history has always been a battle where we strive to live up to our best ideals, but because of racism and other commitments to unjust inequalities, we often fail to do so. He said explicitly, our task is to make this imperfect union more perfect. He didn't deny that the racial and economic injustices are as much a part of America as the aspirations to do better, but he did call Americans to do better. And that's why he likes to say this election is a battle for the soul of America. He is trying to call Americans, in Lincoln's phrase, to the better angels of their nature. And I think most people can grasp that notion that America's past has a dark side that has been deeply constitutive of the nation, but it also has aspirations to do better that have contributed to progress and can contribute to progress and must contribute to progress if we're going to face the crises we have now and move beyond them in a constructive way.
If you were advising Biden about how to construct a message using the tools that you're putting forward in this book, what would you say to him?
I think I'd say two things. First, I would hit hard on the way that Trump's understanding of America denies the message of the Declaration of Independence that we must always strive for greater progress in including all in secure enjoyment of their basic rights. I would emphasize that he's got the story of America wrong. The second thing would be to say that the real proof of that is that to carry the story of America forward in a constructive way, we need to have policies for confronting the deep racial and economic inequalities, as well as the major public health problems and the broader global challenges that the nation faces, and that Trump is not putting forward any policies with any hope of doing that. He's just doubling down on condemning sports teams that don't change their names and defending statues of Andrew Jackson. That's not the way to pursue the story of America in a way that leads to a happier next chapter.
You indicate in the book that the Lincoln version you think has the most, I don't know, the most power of the three. Why?
The basic reason is that it ultimately points most clearly toward the need to extend the protection of basic rights to all within the United States and ultimately to all humanity. It is a national story that has in its aspirations elements to go beyond purely national self-seeking or selfishness, if you will. It is ultimately a story that points to universal goals. The story of perfecting the Constitution addresses all who live under it, but the Constitution does say we're trying to secure the blessings of liberty for ourselves and our posterity. That's not the same as securing it for all humanity. And the kind of democratic story of John Dewey does have the potential to be universally inclusive, but the questions of how we can hope to govern the whole globe democratically are so daunting that this story can quickly come to seem utopian and unrealistic. So for me, the Declaration of Independence story is the most desirable and compelling. However, there are dangers to insisting on any single story. of national identity and purpose. I think that the task instead is to build coalitions amongst those with desirable and overlapping stories. Let me add that there are a growing number of Americans for whom a kind of socialist narrative or America as a social democracy has great appeal. And while that has been very much a minority position in American experience, so I don't think it can be the basis for a broad coalition at the moment. Many proponents of that view see a Declaration of Independence story as too individualistic, and they want to draw on other traditions, looking back to figures like Eugene Debs. I think that's desirable. The quest should not be to insist that this is the best story, but rather drawing on the stories that we find compelling, multiple stories, as in your case. Let's see if we can move the country in directions that we can agree are more positive than where we're going now.
What do you worry about most as we approach this election?
I do worry that Joe Biden, who has not been a particularly effective national campaigner in the past and who's now 77 years old, might, in debates with Donald Trump, not inspire the kind of sense that here's an effective leader that he needs to do in order to defeat Donald Trump. And I worry as well that the efforts of protesters to denounce the very real injustices of America's past and present might get pushed to such an extreme that we are tearing down statues of Grant and Lincoln, along with those of Robert E. Lee and Stonewall Jackson. That kind of radical rejection of everything in America's past can make Trump's position look far more reasonable than it actually is.
Trump and, you know, people justifying similar positions like Newt Gingrich have been suggesting that we have people really attacking more hallowed things like you're suggesting. And I've heard teenagers and young adults talking about how they are not proud of this country. They don't like this country. And that people come out of college very dubious about this country and you know, its ideals and its practices. As we both know, there's plenty of reason for that to be the case. Do you think we've gone too far in deconstructing patriotism on the left?
I think there's a danger of going too far. I certainly wouldn't want to silence the voices of those who say that the nation state system in general is a system of vast inequalities and that America's past and present are filled with unjust inequities. But at the same time, I think that if people are serious about trying to build a better country as a step toward building a better world, then they should recognize the political reality that if the message is relentlessly negative about everything that most Americans care about, they're going to end up empowering the very forces that they seek to oppose. And so instead, I think we do need to look at the positive elements in American experience, the most genuinely inspiring of American ideals. And there's a lot to work with and build on those to try to argue about how we defeat the kind of nostalgia for a white Christian-dominated nation that Donald Trump is advancing, and instead build a nation that treats everyone much more justly than in the past.
Where do you think capitalism fits into that? There's sort of a very resonant critique of capitalism as having produced tremendous inequality and growing inequality. And then there, at the same time, there's the vigor of particularly small companies and innovation and many problems being solved and a lot of strengths to the system, especially when you compare it to countries which have tried alternate ways of creating anything. How do you think that fits into the kind of political philosophy in the U.S.?
Well, the important thing to recognize is that there are many forms of capitalism. The northern European societies that we often call social democracies still have capitalist economic systems in that they have competitive market systems. They don't have national ownership of most forms of production and service industries. They do have some, and they have regulated market economies. You've indicated quite rightly that the features of capitalist market systems as they have emerged in the modern world are that they generate tremendous productivity and innovation, and they can also generate tremendous inequality. The Constitution clearly did seek to promote a country that would have commercial market systems marked by innovation and growth, but we've had different versions of American capitalism over the years. The kind of much more regulated capitalism accompanied by redistributive relief programs of the New Deal era gave way over the past generation to a much more unbridled neoliberal form of capitalism with efforts to reduce government regulations, to reduce government forms of assistance, all in the name of competition and self-reliance, but all in the service of the most extensive economic inequalities in our history. And most people recognize that the result is inequalities of power as well as wealth that grossly distort American constitutional democracy. So there is a very fundamental need to restructure American capitalism. That doesn't mean rejecting capitalism, just as it doesn't mean it in societies that have national health programs and many more measures of social assistance than we do. But it does mean that we have to combat capitalism's great danger, which is the generation of enormous inequality, and I would add oligopolies and monopolies that compound the political dangers of inequality.
Where do you think Trump and Biden fit into that?
There's no question that while Donald Trump is in some ways not at all a liberal, I think he fundamentally embraces a kind of vision of white Christian America that is deeply illiberal. He's a wholehearted capitalist, and the idea of cutting back on regulations, cutting back on redistributive programs, he's all for that. It's probably why the stock market loves him. Joe Biden has been a centrist in the mold of the Clintons and, to a considerable degree, Obama. One of the most important and fascinating questions this year is whether Biden may end up doing what he's already begun to do, if he's elected, pursuing more progressive policies than he would have 5 or 10 years ago, because the Democratic Party, faced with all the severe challenges of contemporary American capitalism, all the inequalities, all the environmental abuses and more, the Democratic Party is demanding a more progressive Democratic administration next time around. And it looks like Joe Biden is signaling that he'll provide it. He might end up being a new FDR, somewhat against his nature. Whether that'll really happen very much remains to be seen. The Biden and Sanders people have been cooperating on task force proposals on a variety of issues. We'll see what those proposals are and which ones Biden supports. That'll be a good indication of how progressive a Biden administration would be.
If you'll indulge me, I just want to ask you some questions about how you got to where you are, which is professor at the University of Pennsylvania, taught at Yale during the time I was there. And
21 years at Yale, 19 at Penn.
Does that mean that you're about to get your 21-year itch, that you're going to have to move to some other Ivy League institution for the next couple decades?
Well, I will probably retire from being a member of a university standing faculty. I don't plan to retire at all from the kind of research and writing on political issues, including American issues, that's always motivated me. I am seeking at this point to make more of a contribution, if I can, to a public discourse, in part because having been in the academy for 40 years working on American politics, I'm deeply dismayed to see that in many respects, things are worse than when I started. That is, Donald Trump is the worst and most dangerous figure in modern American political history. And I do want, over the next 20 years or so, to do all I can to try to push politics in these more inclusive and egalitarian directions that we've been discussing.
Where did you grow up, and how did you, what was your path towards, you know, studying in this area? And
Yes, I was born in South Carolina, but my family, a few months after I was born, moved to Springfield, Illinois, the adult hometown of Abraham Lincoln. And I grew up there very interested in politics, coming from a conservative business family. And I got very involved in the late 1960s in Republican politics in Illinois as a teenager. I was, in fact, the president of the Illinois Teenage Republican Federation. But I saw myself in those days as an Abraham Lincoln Republican. I saw the Republicans as traditionally the party of civil rights. And during that period, the party was turning to the Southern strategy. It was abandoning civil rights and moving to become the party of white racial appeals that unfortunately it has subsequently become. And I was, at the end of my teenage years, profoundly disillusioned and alienated about that. I also came to feel that there was a lot about American politics I clearly didn't understand very well, because I felt I had been active on the wrong side of a lot of the most important issues of my day, or at least the party I was working for was on the wrong side of those issues. So that led me to want to study politics. And I found that for better or worse, my vocation is to be a nerd, to be a scholar and teacher, rather than primarily a political activist. But my scholarship has always been driven by the concerns about the troubling developments in American politics that really shook me as a young man. In some ways, the current moment has brought me back to arguing for a kind of Abraham Lincoln view of American purpose, which is very much my roots.
What did you write your dissertation on?
It was called Liberalism and American Constitutional Law, subsequently published as a book by the Harvard Press. And it was an analysis aimed at criticizing the influential account of Louis Hart's that American political culture had been dominated by an unchanging liberalism from the outset. And I wanted to say that, in fact, the deficiencies of early American liberalism had led to contestation and changes in American understandings of principles over the course of our history. And I tried to use an account of changing constitutional doctrines to show how American liberalism had changed and evolved over time. My subsequent scholarship took that argument further because I came to, when I turned to studying American citizenship, I found that American citizenship laws had been shaped historically by ideologies that seemed to me clearly illiberal, with Stephen Douglas running against Lincoln in 1858 in Illinois, saying that America was built by white men for white men, and that it should always be governed by white men and not any other inferior race. That was the explicit language of Douglass. It was language that continued to be used right up through World War II in justifying American policies, including American immigration policies. My dissertation focused on how liberalism had deficiencies that led to change. My subsequent scholarship has emphasized how America has also been deeply shaped by illiberal traditions, and Donald Trump is very much the voice of those illiberal traditions now.
Among the various many articles and books you've written, is there one that you hold in highest regard that you want to be known for?
There are probably two that within the limited world of academia I'm best known for. One is the book Civic Ideals, Conflicting Visions of Citizenship in U.S. History, published in 1997, which lays out the argument I just summarized about how there have been conceptions of the U.S. as a white man's nation or white Christian man's nation that have competed with emphases on us as a nation devoted to securing rights of all or popular self-governance. But writing that book led me to wonder just why these deeply illiberal narratives of who we are have had such power in American life as well as in the life of many other societies. And so then I wrote a book, Stories of Peoplehood, where I examined more theoretically how it is that narratives of shared political identity are crafted the way they are. And I think those two books together represent the heart of what I've tried to do in my scholarship. I've extended them since. I've pursued other themes as well. But those are the ones that probably stand out the most.
If you're a person who, you know, isn't a professor or a, you know, graduate student, but you're struggling to understand this political moment, maybe through the lens of political philosophy, what else besides, you know, your recent book would you recommend as sort of necessary reading?
I think that there are a number of worthwhile works that have come out recently. I think that it would be salutary for all Americans to read the at least parts of the new collection on African-American political thought that Melvin Rogers and Jack Turner have edited, because I think it's important to encounter and recover many of the diverse voices about the meaning of America. I think that's an enormously valuable contribution. There are a number of primary sources that are valuable to read, and one of the most important is the poem by Langston Hughes that says, let America be America again, the nation that never was yet and yet must be. That is the kind of sense of our national identity that I think people need to grasp and embrace now, and probably the poets convey it more effectively than any of us scholars.
You spent a little bit of time as president of the Political Science Association, American Political Science Association. Where do you think the people who are members of that are right now on, you know, what is a real threat to what you study, to what you, you know, try to explain this Trump administration and where it wants to go?
I think that first important to understand that the American Political Science Association, the profession of political science more broadly, is more diverse than critics of academia realize. There are a number of outstanding conservative political scientists. There are political scientists that support Donald Trump. Nonetheless, the bulk of the profession, I think, is profoundly concerned about the rise of the kind of authoritarian nationalist populisms that Trump represents and that we're seeing in other countries around the world, in Viktor Orban's Hungary, in Narendra Modi's India, in Bolsonaro's Brazil, and many other places. We're concerned, out of some enlightened self-interest, many of these regimes suppress political inquiry and political expression in ways that make the pursuit of political science simply impossible. People are even more concerned because the political science profession, which really emerged in the progressive era with all its flaws as a profession that hoped to advanced democratic citizenship in the world. Many in the profession today feel that politics is going sour in ways that they have a collective responsibility to understand, but also to try to address constructively. I think that's a very shared mood, widely shared mood in the profession at the moment.
Has that caused you to alter your teaching? I've talked to other professors who've said, you know, they've been much more open about their political beliefs in this moment than they had before because they felt the changes so personally. Do you feel that way? Have you changed how you convey things to students about yourself and this time?
Not dramatically, but that's because I began changing a number of years ago as I saw American political polarization heightening. Even before that, I had made a decision early in my career to indicate briefly where my own views were so that students could take them into account in judging what they were being taught. I've never made my teaching centrally about my own views, and I don't do so today. But if anything, I've tried harder in recent years, including this year, to try to make my classrooms a place where people really are comfortable expressing sharp disagreements over political issues, because the only way to get past polarization, I believe, if we don't want a violent war of extinction of our opponents, the only way to get past it is by promoting more genuine communication about where people agree or disagree. So I've tried to make more space for conservatives to feel free they can speak out. I've also tried to make sure that radical left perspectives feel welcome in my classroom. And while, of course, it doesn't always work, it is true that the student evaluations come back saying, I really did feel that I was engaging different points of view and felt compelled to rethink my own in ways that have affected my thinking. That's what I'm going for in my teaching now more than ever before.
There's some people who think that debate is being curtailed at universities now. Do you see that? And do you worry about that?
I don't think that debate is being curtailed as a result of university policies to any substantial extent. Most universities, and certainly the University of Pennsylvania, have strong commitments to academic freedom. It is true that we have a part of our political culture, and well represented in academia, is that some views are considered shameful to say, and the kind of shaming process that people experience socially amongst students and sometimes amongst faculty, that has a chilling effect on people saying what they really think. But having said that, I'm involved in several projects now which actively try to bring together people from different points of view to promote engaged dialogue across differences. I see more of an appetite for that right now than I have in a number of years. And I think it reflects the fact that more and more people are realizing that polarization and silencing aren't doing us any good. There is something to the concerns about cancel cultures, but at the same time, the articulation of those concerns shows that we still have a lot of spaces And in some ways, you're getting more spaces in which a diversity of views are engaged.
Is there a question I didn't ask that you would like to answer about your book or anything else currently in politics?
The question about the work that I've done that you didn't push, that others do, is the question of whether it's really important to pay attention to all this stuff about stories and narratives and symbols at all. There is a view that has proponents right, left, and center that understands politics simply to be driven by competing material interests and material interests that acquire power in one form or another. And so that if you're not talking about wealth and power, you're really not talking about what's important in politics. I do think wealth and power, economic structures and political and military power structures are crucial to politics. But I also think you don't really understand how people come to see their material interests the way they are, how they come to structure economies and political institutions and military establishments as they do, if you don't understand their stories of identity and purpose that are mobilizing support for what they're trying to do, as well as providing substantive guidance to what they try to do. And I think my profession has underestimated the significance of stories in politics. The fact that Donald Trump is trying to revive his campaign by launching his story of America as threatened by the cultural left, and the fact that Biden is beginning to respond by saying you've got the story of America wrong, I think that shows that this is a central element in understanding how politics works and must work if we're to build communities and institutions that can really contribute to meeting human needs.
I think I didn't ask that because I think I agree kind of profoundly with that. It's my understanding of politics, really, that deeply we are telling stories over time, and that those stories are contested and continue to be. That war between stories just is ongoing.
Well, I couldn't agree more.
Well, it's been really an honor to talk to you, Rogers. I appreciate the time. Anything else you want to say?
Just my thanks to you. These were excellent and important questions, and I really appreciate the opportunity to talk about them with you.
That was Professor Roger Smith at UPenn. This is Nathaniel G. Perlman with the Great Battlefield Podcast. You can find us at greatbattlefield.com or by searching for Great Battlefield in places where podcasts are found.